Hi, everyone. It's Debbie Steinberg-Koontz, licensed marriage and family therapist and founder of Bright and Quirky. I am so excited to be speaking to two world-renowned experts today, Dr. Cliff Sussman and Michael Delman. Dr. Cliff is internationally known as a pioneer in treating internet and video game addiction. He's been in private practice in psychiatry for children, adolescents, and young adults in Washington, D.C. since 2008. He's been featured as an authority on screen use related issues throughout the media and peer review literature, and has presented on the topic to audiences of all types and sizes at conferences, hospitals, schools, locally and internationally. Michael Delman is an author, school founder, and award-winning educator in the area of executive function coaching. He served as CEO and founder of Beyond Book Smart, the nation's largest executive function coaching company since 2006. He's also the author of Your Kid's Gonna Be Okay, Building the Executive Function Skills Your Child Needs in the Age of Attention. Gentlemen, welcome to the summit.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I'd love to start with Dr. Cliff. It's been a tough year. A lot of our kids' activities are not going on currently, like sports or scouts. There's a lot of digital binging going on, whether it's video games, web surfing, social media. First of all, I'd just like to ask, why is that so engaging?
Yeah, that's, well, screen time is incredibly engaging. There's a lot of reasons. It's a great question. Among those reasons are that the kind of more obvious ones, like it's an escape. It's an escape from a really tough world to be in right now. And you can go into a virtual world where things are much more the way you want them to be. It's a social aid. You know, it's a way to socialize at a time when people are really isolated. And even outside of social media, you know, things that are made just for socializing, there's social aspects of just about everything that's online now. Games have become a lot more social with multiplayer games. And so, you know, it's definitely a place where people go to seek social connection. And I think perhaps one of the biggest reasons and most important reasons why screens are just so alluring is because they provide our brains with instant and continuous stimulation. And this is what especially the young growing brain really wants. It wants to have stimulation right away. It doesn't want to wait for it, and it wants to have it continuously. And you can get that from a screen almost better than you can from any other drug or addictive activity.
I think this is so fascinating, and I was looking through your work, and the whole aspect of how dopamine is involved is absolutely fascinating. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that, and also when does it become problematic?
Yeah, well, dopamine is the pleasure neurotransmitter of the brain, and it's designed so that based a lot on time, so that the release is based on time. In other words, the less time you have to wait for an intended effect or an intended stimuli or reward, the more dopamine is released. It has a lot more to do with that delay. That instant gratification that it has to do with, you know, what you're getting pleasure from or how intense the stimuli is. So dopamine is released in response basically to instant gratification. And then because the gratification with screens, like I said, is continuous, you know, kids will tend to binge and they'll get dopamine released for hours and hours and hours and days on end. And, not just kids, of course. And, you know, what happens is we become desensitized to dopamine and its effects. We become, the receptors in our brain for dopamine go down. We have fewer of them, and then we're less able to feel pleasure. And not just the pleasure you get from a video game, but any kind of pleasure, any kind of reward becomes, it's like we develop a tolerance to it. And so it's
sort of like with an alcoholic,
exactly,
you would need a higher dose, more drinks.
Right. You need more drinks to get the same amount of a buzz if you're a heavy drinker. And it's the same thing with you know, just continually getting dopamine release. You need more things that you need to seek more instant gratification to get the same relief. And so what happens is kids who will binge all the time, you know, on screens, they find that the other things in life, such as their classes, particularly when they're online classes to begin with, are not as stimulating. That's a real problem.
That is a real problem. And we're going to want to talk to Michael about that. Maybe we can go there right now. Yeah. Is that what you're seeing, Michael, that some of these kids who are overusing screens, that a lack of motivation or engagement in school is sort of correlated with that?
Yeah, well, you got to look at the competition. I taught for a long time, and right. And I was a school principal. And you know, when you're trying to engage students, you know, there are teachers, to be sure, who really understand, and they use effective teaching strategies, whether in person or even the really phenomenal ones online. They might gamify their classes in some fashion, have challenges where they split the class into groups that are working on projects together and competing for points in a fun way that, you know, no one really loses in the end. Teachers can have high interest content that kids can connect with, and they can check in with students to engage with them through accountability. That's what teachers do at their very best. When the teachers are feeling good and their energy level is high. And you imagine what toll this is all taking, the pandemic, et cetera, on kids. It's taking it on teachers who are doing far more prep than they've ever had to do. And those are the best teachers. And then imagine just an average teacher who is used to getting up and just lecturing and just delivering information, who says things like, well, I taught it. If they didn't learn it, they didn't learn it, but I taught it, meaning they said it, so therefore they taught it. That's a very low bar for a screen to go beyond. So, you know, for a kid to be able to get these back and forth engagement with their friends on, you know, one of their social media platforms, or to watch a TikTok video, which is like, you know, that's all the rage now, Instagram posts and, you know, and then the next thing, those are just so much more compelling. And so it is much harder for kids in school now, and it's much harder for teachers. The bar has been raised by all these things always, as the challenge for the teachers has gotten much harder as well.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. It's like, how do we make education more of a high dopamine activity, or how do we get kids more used to low dopamine activities? And Dr. Cliff, you talk a lot about that. Can you talk about the balance of those?
Yeah. I mean, I came up with those terms because I like that, you know, high dopamine activities had the abbreviations HDA, and low dopamine activity had LDA. And it made me think of those like cholesterol tests you get, you know, which I just thought it would catch with people better. But, you know, the idea is that a high dopamine activity is an activity that gives you gratification instantly, and thus releases a lot of dopamine. And a low dopamine activity is an activity that requires patience, that has a delay in gratification. So you may take all the activities you do and kind of sort them in terms of how much patience they require. And you may decide that things like playing a video game, you know, obvious ones, you know, drinking alcohol, you know, smoking cigarettes, that, you know, or even using social media and doing a lot of the other sort of instantly gratifying screen activities would all go into the high dopamine category. And the activities like, you know, doing homework or, you know, activities where the reward you really have to wait for, activities like sitting through an online class, you know, so a low dopamine activity can be on a screen. There's many other examples, activities like playing a board game where there's a lot of setup and a lot of waiting your turn, activities like, doing an arts and crafts project or learning to play an instrument. You might sort all those into the clearly low dopamine, but remember it's a continuum. There may be activities that you're not sure where to put that are kind of in between. They take a little more patience than a video game. So you may put it anywhere along the continuum, and then you may decide to move it to one side or the other. But the main idea is that if you want to keep in check this phenomenon of, you know, this high tolerance to pleasure and, you know, being really easily bored, which we've also called reward deficiency syndrome in the literature. If you want to keep that in check, the key is to have a balance between these high and low dopamine activities. And I've come up with a lot of strategies for doing that, that I'll share with my families and my patients.
Oh, Debbie, if I just jump in as a lot, you know, elaborating that from an educational front for a moment. Well, you know, first off, I really appreciate Dr. Cliff, the whole distinction between the dopamine level and the fact that not all of it is about screens, although screens are such a clear place of it. But there are certain sports where the dopamine rush is ongoing and fast. And I tend to like those sports quite a bit. And, and with a lot of good salutary effects on the body and the mind and all that. From an educator's perspective, just here's a contrast. You know, you could have groups of students brainstorming together and they're timed. They're given 90 seconds or 2 minutes to brainstorm all of the blah, 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 whatever it is.
Yeah.
In a social studies classes, possible causes of such and such historic event. And they're bouncing off of each other and kids are jotting it down. They're adding it to a board. They're putting them on stickies. And you could have a parallel in the online world where you're putting notes up. There's an app for that now, an app where you can put stickies on a board, basically, that everyone can contribute to. So that could be high dopamine. It's timed. There's an instant reward. You're seeing your work go up. People can comment on your sticky the moment it goes up. That's really exciting. There are all sorts of cool things like that. On the other hand, you might have a low dopamine activity where people are working on an outline that's slow. And you have to reorganize it and think about proper sequencing. And, you know, is this a big idea or is it a supporting idea? So though I think the key thing, and this is where kind of Dr. Cliff and I, you know, like where there's overlap between our two fields, is we're looking at, well, how do you balance those? And it begins, as Dr. Cliff said, with understanding when you're one of the adults, well, what kind of level of dopamine is this? And also teaching that to kids so they can start to understand that, because that self-awareness is like a really great opportunity for them.
I was just going to comment on one of the things Michael said, if I may. You know, kids really do want to learn about the brain. And another area that what you do and what I do overlaps a lot, I can tell just from talking to you and listening to you, is that we both try to meet kids where they are.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so for parents hearing about this dopamine dynamic for the first time, would it sort of be like, okay, we have to eat, and there's nutritious food and junk food, and maybe the junk food is the high dopamine, and we create boundaries and balance. Would that be an analogy?
Sure. I mean, that would, I don't know if, you may get some of the same kind of, resistance, just like, you may get resistance from kids, who have a different idea of what's good and bad for them. I think there's a lot of good analogies for it. But what kids need to understand is that, there can be too much of even a good thing. And that, you know, unlike junk food, you could make the case that a lot of the things that kids do on a screen do have some real redeeming values, even some of the high dopamine stuff. I mean, I love doing puzzles and games myself. I got into this because I was a gamer and I liked the way, you know, I like stimulating my brain. I like learning things and I like challenges. And kids love the challenges of video games and, you know, the way the different ways it makes them have to think to solve the problems that it presents, and just the way it can trigger their imagination. For me, it wasn't just about wanting to play video games; it was about wanting to make them and create them and learn to program and design them that got me really into it. So, you're saying the kids, yeah, we get it. Like, we know this is a good thing. We're not saying that all video games are bad, but you know, you can have too much of a good thing and that you need some balance. You need, if you're just doing one activity all the time to the point where, you know, the rest of your life is falling apart and getting neglected, then, you know, that's not such a good thing.
Michael? Yeah. I mean, just in terms of the labeling of good and bad, we're allowed to have our own secret judgments as parents. Yeah. Some of them we might say, well, that one might have some good. Like I have a smallish addiction to Wordscapes. It's a word game.
Right.
It does build vocabulary mm-hmm. and it does build some kind of out of the box thinking and intersection, you know, like spatial awareness with it. But it's really kind of an addiction. But I mostly indulge it in the weekend during tournament time. Is it good? Is it bad? It's got some good. It's a little bit goofy. You know, if I spend too long and I'm not doing other things, like, you know, because sorry, I'm in a tournament. I can't talk to anybody. You know, that's when it's maybe not so good.
Yeah.
Whereas there may be other things where we'd say tough to kind of find the good in it for us. But, you know, I think that in terms of what you were saying, Dr. Cliff, about kind of meeting people where they are, there's a little bit of understanding with kids that there's a way to talk to them that can help them. And Debbie, sure. I think that's kind of the, you know, the thing is, well, how do we talk to our kids in a way that they're actually going to listen?
Yeah. And if you just approach them in a way that completely rejects what they're into, you know, you're probably going to just push them away, and lose their, you know, their attention. So I think it's important for parents to learn how to at least validate and acknowledge their children's interests and what their kids like to do and their frustration with having to stop. I think parents sometimes have a tough time distinguishing between, you know, validating feelings versus validating behaviors, you know, and you don't have to approve of a game they're playing and you don't have to approve of a behavior they're doing in order to at least validate, you know, their feelings and concerns. And sometimes that can really kind of de-escalate a situation. And those situations come up pretty frequently with my patients and their families.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I made the analogy to healthy food and junk food, when I try and go on a diet where there's no treats, it never lasts. You know, if I can have my chocolate at 3 o'clock and my cookie after dinner, then it'll last. I think it's all about moderation.
Well, the thing about food, it being a particularly good analogy, is that both with food, you know, you can make the case, maybe not junk food, but with food in general, you can't just be abstinent from food. You can't just starve, you know. Exactly. And junk food is pretty ubiquitous. Like, you know, you have birthday parties with cakes. It's like junk food's always coming at us in all directions, just like screens are. You know, people's devices are everywhere now, and you can't avoid it. It's so ubiquitous. You can't really do anything without a screen in today's society. So to think that people are going to be completely abstinent from video games or from other screen activities is really unrealistic, especially because even when you're doing low dopamine activities on a screen, you have very easy access to your high dopamine activities. So it's like drinking water in a bar, going back to your alcoholic analogy. So yeah, I think that you know, there's definitely, I compare, you know, binge eating to binge gaming a lot.
Okay. I want to try a little experiment. I know parents like to know what words to use. So if we could pretend for a minute that I'm a parent talking to my 12-year-old and you guys just correct me where I'm wrong or add to it. Can we try that? Okay.
I like that.
All right. Honey, I love seeing you having fun online, whether it's video games and you're whooping it up with your friends, or you're scrolling through social media, catching up with your friends. I love that you can be social, especially during this time of social distancing. But what concerns me is that you seem to be taking less pleasure in things. You're in a bad mood when you get off. We're having these power struggles about finding balance. And, you know, I want to get along as a family. I want to hear your thoughts on how these screens play in your life. And I really would like to, for us to run some experiments to find some more balance.
Yeah, I thought that was really good. I mean, I didn't really have to correct you anywhere. I thought it was a very validating statement, and you know, was very joining.
Good.
I thought it was awful, just terrible. is it helpful? I thought it was great, Debbie. So the only thing that I was curious about was whether the conversation had been kind of agreed to by both parties ahead of time. And obviously we didn't frame it for that or not, but I do think it is one of those kinds of assumed things that when we approach our kids, cause we're in the mood to chat with them about something that, well, this works for me. Why don't I chat for, this will just be a few minutes. But if they're not in the mood to talk, and this is particularly a bad time to talk to them, it could all go sideways. Even when you've done a nice job of not judging, understanding value, putting it in the context of the stress that they're under to show some empathy for where they're coming from. So I think, you know, this kind of knocking before entering piece of, Alyssa, I want to chat for a few minutes. Is this an okay time? Something on my mind, or is this a good time? And they say no, and you know, and giving them maybe a forced choice. Well, you know, it could wait maybe after dinner, or if not, why don't we set up a time to talk?
Absolutely. Yeah, we want to.
I like to put parental interventions in steps. Like I like parents to go step by step. Like the first step is everyone safe? Are we in the middle of a volatile situation? You know, the second step is everyone regulated? You know, is everyone like in a place where they can like actually listen to that and not you know, have a tantrum or get aggressive or just be like, shut up, leave me alone. You know, and then it's like, you have to be in the right place and time for that. But there are some kids, like, no matter how good a job you do of validating them and talking to them about it, you know, who are just so addicted that they're in seeking mode and they're not regulated and, you know, they're not going to be able to really listen to you. And, you know, and it's cases like that where you may need some extra help, or you may need some additional limit setting that, you know, and you may not find that you just can't reason with them yet. You know, they're not in a place yet where they're really going to listen to reason, because what's going on in their mind is just getting their next fix by any means necessary. And that's when you're dealing with addiction. You know, addiction is something that's very hard to reason with. But at the same time, you know, I really do want to encourage parents to learn to validate their kids the way you just did.
Okay, great. So let's say we now go into brainstorming. What are some strategies that families can play around with to find balance? And then at what point would we say, okay, those haven't worked. Maybe we are dealing with addiction.
Maybe I'll take the easier part, which is before we get to the addiction. Yeah. Dr. Cliff is the person with the kind of the expertise in addiction. And frankly, I wouldn't be trying to work with someone who's at that point. That wouldn't really be my domain.
Yeah.
With executive function regulation and improvement. So before, they're not in that place yet. This is a kid who just they really like it a lot, and they struggle, and they get pulled into that, you know, vortex sometimes. And it's affecting their work, and it's affecting their happiness. But, you know, on that continuum, and I realize it's not just all in or all out, it's some, but on the continuum, there sometimes it's a problem, but not all the time, and not at a really extreme level. I think you can use anything from like a Ross Green kind of, you know, collaborative problem solving methods. So things where let's hear your thoughts. Let me share my thoughts. Let us try to find what the values are that are at stake. And when you're having that brainstorming, as you asked, I think it's really important, the sequencing of it all. The order matters a lot. The kids got to go first with their perspective. And our job after that is not to share our perspective, because then that's just simply arguing. It's to validate what they said and to make sure they know that we heard them. So, you know, my kid says, I don't have a problem with screens. And you say, got it. As far as you're concerned, there is no problem. This is just me making a massive deal out of nothing. Did I get that right? Yep. All right. Now I feel like I heard you. Now I'd like to share my perspective. Are you okay to listen? And so then it's, well, you know, what I'm seeing is, and really instead of judgments, try to say what the video camera, to use a tech analogy, but to say what we would actually be seeing. What I see is, you know, what I observe, so observable behaviors, the way you did a moment ago. And then their job is actually to reflect it back. It's not to come to agreement, because that's going to be some ways down the road. I did this when my kids were as young as like 4 and 8 years old, when they would have a difference of opinion. I would make the older one first listen and restate, and then the younger one would have to do it in little ways. I mean, when they're really, really, really little, and it's, you know, and yeah, they get better and better at it, but it's an important thing. We're not just trying to change the behavior. We're trying to get them to see another point of view, even though they're not going to fully see it, even though they're not going to fully get it. And then, you know, you look for points of overlap there. And I think the next thing is really experimenting. It's small experiments. And when you try little experiments, like, well, I would like to see if you really can handle being like, I'm not going to give you a time limit overall, but I'd like to see if you can do 30 minutes on and then take a break and still be in a decent mood after that. Because as Dr. Cliff has, I've gotten to hear him speak before, talked with, the length of time really matters for dopamine replenishment and things like that to not get addicted. So an experiment like that might yield some data. And then you can say, well, it seemed like you were okay with that 30 minute thing. And now you're saying you want to be able to go for an hour. I've got some concerns about that, but you know, the data doesn't really, the research out there doesn't really support you, but maybe you're an exception. And by the way, I've got two kids and they're very different from each other. And what's true for one isn't always true for the other. So I'd turn it over to Dr. Cliff now for running the experiments. And then when you find out that the data is yielding not so good, you know, results.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I really appreciate your approach with that. I think that one of the things that really stands out about the way you talk to people and encourage parents to is that it's you have a large part of it is reflective listening, what I would call reflective listening, which as a therapist, I incorporate that into my practice. You know, it's used in a technique called motivational interviewing, which was developed for treating addiction. And it's often an approach I'll use with my patients. And it's a very reflective style of listening. And it involves a lot of, instead of us giving our insight to kids and say, you know, becoming just an authority figure saying, you do as I say, it's more about, you know, helping kids come up with insight from within, you know, and what is their motivation to change? You know, maybe it doesn't have to be because we want them to. Maybe it's because they want to earn our trust and they want to earn more privileges.
Dr. You know, and that's what are some actual questions you would ask as part of motivational interviewing?
Yeah, well, they're all very open-ended questions. Right. So, because you really want to get kids talking and exploring their own insight. So I may ask something like, you know, not do you think you have a problem with video games? I might say, you know, how do you think you do with setting limits with yourself on video games? Or how much of a balance do you think you have? You know, and get them to explore that. You know, what sorts of benefits do you get out of playing video games? You know, what makes you keep coming back to it? What makes it a problem for you? You know, what sorts of problems have you seen in your life because of playing video games? You know, get them to tell me rather than having me sit there telling them about all the problems in their life. You know,
those questions are gold. Those are great.
Right. And that's, you know, that's most important for psychotherapists. I don't expect parents to sit down and do motivational interviewing with their kids, but they can certainly, you know, take some of the techniques from that, like the reflective listening and being validating and trying to meet your kids where they are and explore their ambivalence about things rather than just having a power struggle with them, which is seldom productive.
Absolutely. I want to get into really brass tacks about, okay, we've all decided that doing less screen time is a good idea.
Yeah.
But a lot of kids, when they turn off the screens, and parents are working, they're sort of like, what now?
Yeah, right.
So would you have a list of things you can do? Would you have...
Yeah, you know, yeah, it's not all just about... Right, I mean, I do have a list of like recommendations that I'll give to families even before I've, you know, to all families, not just when I've determined their kid's addicted, you know? You know, I think there are some really clear steps that parents can take outside of what they say to their kids. Like, I think that what's really important is to be aware of the environmental cues in your home, especially in a distance learning setting, because the brain is triggered by cues, right? When the alcoholic does walk into the bar, they get dopamine released before they even have their first drink. Why? Because the smells of the bar, the sights of the bar, the sounds of the bar, they see the alcohol. It's like they're in their environment for drinking. You know, when your kid walks into a room to take a virtual class and they sit down at a desk and there's, you know, a tablet and a phone on the desk next to them, and they're doing it on their gaming computer, and they've got who knows all sorts of other distractions in the room. I mean, they're basically,
they're already halfway there.
Right. Exactly. It's, you know, it's a losing battle. It's like you're setting them up to fail. And that's something that parents really can, I think, without too much difficulty, adjust. They can adjust the environment where their kid's taking their classes. They can set up a screen-free zone in the house, you know, with a bunch of low dopamine activities where they can stay in during their low dopamine blocks or periods of time when you want them, you know, taking a break. You can... you know, maybe even give them a couple different devices, one for just classes and work, you know, that they associate with classes and work, and another device in another completely separate area for when they do their gaming and their high dopamine activities. So there's lots of environmental adjustments that parents can make once they're aware of their kids' cues, which a lot of parents are aware of them already. You can also try to add as much structure as possible to these long stretches of unstructured time in your kid's schedule. You know, that's something that parents are not always sure they need to do. You know, they're like, oh, am I going to overprogram them? But I think that, you know, if kids have a Saturday and Sunday every week, and this was even a problem before distance learning, you know, with where they're just sitting at home all day with no structured activities, that's a problem. You know, again, you're kind of setting them up for failure. You can also make sure their social needs are being addressed so that they don't, so that they have other options besides a screen to, you know, achieve that balance. I mean, this is especially important with younger kids when they may not be able to really discuss these things with you yet, you know, the way you'd like them to. Absolutely. And it's important with early teens who may be, you know, still not at a stage where you can really reason with them because they're still a little bit defiant and rebellious and, you know, will tend to do the opposite of what you tell them to do. But if you make these changes in their environment, you know, it's often painless. And the truth is that, with the beauty of structure is that with structure, you don't need willpower. So
yes.
If you have something to do, like playing a soccer game, during that entire soccer game, you're not going to see a kid pull out his cell phone, usually. You know, maybe when they're on the bench, but while they're playing, you're not going to see that. And it takes a lot less willpower for that to happen than for them to, you know, be just sitting at home for the same stretch of time without taking out your cell phone. And I'm happy to also talk about, you know, the follow-up to your question previously about when it's addiction and what to do then.
Yeah. Yeah. Please do. Yeah.
So, you know, signs that this is really an out of control problem are things like, when it's not the amount of hours the kid is playing or, it's not necessarily how frequently they're on a screen. What really defines addiction is the negative impact it has on your life and your functioning. So it's things like academic problems, you know, especially when there's like a sudden crash in grades or dropping out of school, social problems, health problems, you know, psychological problems like anxiety and depression, suicidality, you know, especially if kids are like, you know, if you take my screens from me, I'm going to have no point to living and I'm going to kill myself. You know, obviously that's a sign there's a real problem.
And what about low grade discontent, kind of like a dysthymia?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's the reward deficiency syndrome type thing that I was describing earlier, where just like everything seems boring. You know, it could be that you're irritable all the time. There's often kids who are just more aggressive than they would be otherwise. But particularly, it's a problem if they're aggressive around screen limits. You know, but there's kids who will... you know, steal to play video games or you know, I've seen lots of money taken from parents' credit cards. I've seen lots of lying around gaming. You know, those are real addiction signs. Just constantly seeking, you know, seeking behaviors, we would call them. You know, that's time that maybe, you know, that may be the time to get some professional help if you start to see things like that, you know, and take those suicidal threats very seriously, because we know that people with addiction are more likely to kill themselves and people during this time are more likely to kill themselves. And so, you know, and teenagers, unfortunately, are a high risk group for that. So, you know, those are signs that may be time to get help. And, you know, you may need a more higher level intervention, which can range from something like a dopamine detox done on an outpatient basis with regular follow-up for with some family work and some individual therapy, you know, and you integrate the kid into eventually balanced use and then eventually self-regulation. And it may be a higher level of care, like an inpatient program that provides those types of steps.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you, Dr. Cliff. Sure. Michael, I want to talk a little bit about self-control and teens, especially our bright and quirky kids who may have ADHD. Is it reasonable to think that they could develop self-control when these forces of video games and social media and things are so interesting? Or are we thinking that we need to have some apps in place to sort of structure what they can access and how long they can access it for?
You know, there's always the tension between what is necessary and what is possible. And sometimes what's necessary isn't immediately possible, but you strive toward it. So it's not always possible. Look, you know, if you've got teenagers who have a pretty severe case of ADHD, you're looking at a 3-year lag in development in a lot of ways. So, you know, we want to set some realistic expectations, but it should be seen as a, dare I say, peaceful transfer of power. We're looking at the beginning, really a necessity of parents setting some limits when we see that, you know, you're looking at your 8-year-old, your 9-year-old, your 10, 11-year-old, but you're starting to get into 11, 12, 13, 14. There's got to be more kind of metacognitive, more self-aware piece where that there's shared power. So yes, it is absolutely possible. So one of the things then is about, again, gathering data and having perhaps instead of your child doing their homework alone in their room where you have no idea what's going on, either that's fine if you're able to look at something like screen time or other apps that track as opposed to control. So I'd say in between a laissez-faire parenting style, which just, I trust you, you're 9, do whatever, I'm sure it'll all work out, or a command and control, I don't care if you're 18 years old, I'll tell you exactly what's what, young man. You know, somewhere in between is well, okay, you're 12 years old. Let's track this situation. Let's see what's going on. And then, okay, let's agree on some reasonable limits. So, you know, I realize that's could be seen as kind of plain vanilla, Debbie, and I'm happy for you to push back. But it is a gradual release. You are trying to sunset yourself out so that when they go to college, you're not going with them. And that really, you know, that really is it is a gradual release. So yeah, you can use apps like Forest on my phone. I use that for myself to manage my, you know, I'll pull this up and here's my productivity section of my phone. And then, oh, there it is. There's Forest. And I'm going to set myself 20 minutes. And there it is. It's saying don't mess around. And then, you know, I close up my phone and I start to open up my chat. And maybe I'm going to go for I got a notification already. And it just says, basically, if you do this again, you'll kill your tree.
I like that app.
You could look and see all the dead trees in your kid's forest. And that's a conversation. So, you know, I think that these are some of the handoffs that you want, because we say we want to, and yet we're really afraid to, because we are wired as parents. We are wired to protect our kids from threats. And when we see them, you know, kind of flailing, we want to rescue them. And sometimes the way we rescue actually does more damage than good, because we're not really teaching them that skill of self-sufficiency. On the other hand, I wouldn't just push them out of the nest till they're ready. So it's a teaching process.
Sure.
I think that's so important to model that, you know, I have trouble too when I'm watching Netflix and I'm watching The Crown, which is one of my favorite shows, and it automatically starts playing the next one at 10:30 p.m. when I know I should be going to bed. It's like, oh my gosh, that happened to Diana. I got to watch what happens now.
You know?
It happens to us too.
And they want it to happen. It's not by accident. It's by design.
Oh yeah.
You know, all these things, YouTube, next video in 3, 2, 1, you know, all these things. So it really is up to us to say, what's my limit and stick to that. Not, you know, just because we're, by doing so, we're kind of reinforcing the pathways that prove to us that when we say limit, when we set limits, we mean it, as opposed to every time we give up on self-imposed limits, we start to doubt, so I set it. I can change my mind. I'm a free person, you know? Well, but then what, you know, to what extent do you actually mean anything? So, and I think with our kids, having them learn to set limits, I'd rather have my kid set a limit that's a little bit more than I would want them to have, but hold to it, than to have something less and not hold to it. That's why the whole collaborative conversation is so important, Because what the more that they see, and I think this is the essential point, the more that they see that they actually do have some self-control, the more that they are able to then exercise that in the future. So there's a reinforcing mechanism. And the more that they see that, my word is garbage. they're not even going to bother to try. So this is, it's having a good batting average, not perfect, but a good batting average and setting realistic goals.
Got it. Very important. Very important. Dr. Cliff, so Michael mentioned Forest. What are some other apps and tools that you like? Because I get that question a lot.
Well, first, a word of warning on apps and tools, and just a word of caution that you're not going to get between an addict and their drug. At best, they're going to be poor at covering their tracks and you're going to catch them. But for parents to think that they're going to find like the perfect parental control software that their kids can't hack through, think again.
Let me just reframe if I can.
Yeah.
I totally agree, and we should talk about the instance with addicts. Also, I've talked to my kids about, it's all hard for us to find balance. Mm-hmm. What if we all had apps that create a curfew on our phone?
I'm not a huge fan of those apps, and there's other reasons why. My favorite apps are the ones that just do monitoring and give you feedback, like screen time, where you can see how many hours you can see the consequence of your behaviors. Mm-hmm. But apps that actually do the limit setting, I find often fail, just in my experience, and not just with addicts. I find that, it's like you're relying on the app to do it, and you're not really finding as much inner strength, I find that kids will maybe, or parents will use those apps for a while and give up on them very quickly. I guess it depends more on the user than the app. You know, I think you're more likely to have success with an app if you really commit to it and stick to it. And, you really want to use that app. I think using apps to monitor or using apps to set limits with other people very rarely works. And I really think parents have a lot of, unfortunately, hands-on jobs in setting limits. Like it's really important, I think, to actually check on your kids in person from time to time, especially when they're supposed to be doing low dopamine activities, maybe set some clear rules, have some stated ahead of time consequences that are reasonable and logical and maybe natural. Expect that your kids are going to fail sometimes. You kind of want them to, because that's how we learn. You're not a failure as a parent if your kid doesn't follow every limit you set. It's just important that you're consistent with the consequences for it and that you follow through on what you say is going to happen. It may be that, they lose their next block of high dopamine activity because they were on a cell phone when they were supposed to be, playing a board game together. I think that I wouldn't rely too much on the fighting fire with fire approach of using technology for
that.
I'm
really relieved that you said that.
But whatever works, if it helps, then do it. It's just, in my experience, it hasn't helped that much.
I'm actually really relieved that you said that because I'm not techie and I can't figure out most of that. And I think of that kid that they profiled in the movie Screenagers, who went off to college and didn't go to any classes and was just in his dorm room playing games all the time.
Right, right.
So I think what's just crystallizing for me out of this talk is just like it's a skill to eat well, get your homework done.
Yeah.
There's a skill of tech moderation.
Yeah.
That we all need to learn.
That's right. That's right.
That is a very important point.
So, I would just give a tale of two screenagers, if you will. One student I know, and his mother is a very sophisticated person, and she tried the command and control approach with every kind of app blocker, lock mechanism possible, including physically locking the kid's screen things in the car. The kid broke into the car. I mean, There was no stopping this kid. The other hand, there was an eighth grader I worked with who had a screen problem, not an addiction, but a problem. And she knew she needed to really manage herself better during English papers, when she was drafting and revising English papers, because that's where the background stuff, the distractions would really, really interfere with her performance. She used this app called Self Control. It is a blacklist, whitelist kind of thing.
Yeah.
You can break it if you really are determined to, but she chose to use it. And even the name of the app is a great one, Self Control.
Yeah.
And after doing it for a week, she texted me, total game changer, essays right on track. I love this. And in, you know, this was the thing that really worked for her. Again, there's an ownership piece. And so when you're talking about the, you know, oh yeah, what you said, Debbie, about, you know, management of screens, management of technology. Yeah, we can't avoid it. It's here.
Yeah.
But it's, can we manage it? And like anything else.
So true. So true. So I know we need to wrap up. What last thoughts from the heart would you like to leave with parents? Dr. Cliff, do you want to go first?
Well, that we understand that this is a really, really tough time. And I think that, you know, parents have to, you know, cut themselves some slack because, you know, distance learning has been a disaster a lot of the time. It's not going that great. I didn't think it would. You know, there's exceptions. This pandemic has just created a huge emotional burden on everybody, and it's socially isolated people. So, you know, this is a struggle. And so if it's not a struggle, you may be doing something wrong. Like, so expect this to be hard, you know, try your best to not give up and to make sure that you're not just throwing in the towel and being like, okay, I'm going to go to that other extreme of parenting where I just enable everything. You know, having some limits are better than none.
Absolutely. And I just want to let parents know in this summit, we've got a talk with Dr. Kristen Neff on self-compassion. That can be very helpful here. And also a talk with Rafael Boccamazzo on his experience as a gamer and balance. So those are two connected talks. Michael, last thoughts for you?
Yeah, they're very similar actually to Dr. Cliff. I think it's a balancing act, but I think it's a balancing act where you may fall to one side or another from time to time. It is important to be gentle and compassionate with our kids, with ourselves, and it's also important to push ourselves to do just about as well as we can in any given moment.
Yeah.
And understand that, you know, a moment or struggling, you know, struggling is par for the course right now. And yet we should keep up the good struggle. That's okay. You know, we're going to get through this, but we need to get through this. And so, when we all look back, in 6 months, 8 months, whenever, you know, we really have this pandemic under control, we want to be able to say, well, you know, I didn't beat myself up too badly, but I tried. I did all right, all things considered. And I think that would be a good way to be able to look back and keep that in mind as we go.
I agree. I definitely agree. Thank you so much to both of you. This was really enlightening. Michael, your website is beyondbooksmart.com. And Dr. Cliff, what is your website?
It's www.cliffordsussmanmd.com. All one word. And there's a lot of additional resources for people on it.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much to both of you. It's been wonderful.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Bye.